Hey podcaster, welcome to the Lockdown Show podcast with me, SCG. You're most likely listening to this on iTunes or Spotify, and thank you so much for checking this show out. And if you like this content, head over to YouTube and subscribe to my channel, The SCG Show, and look for the playlist, The Lockdown Show Podcast, to hear more. Okay, let's begin with today's special episode. Okay, Dr. Kevin Voss, thank you very much for coming back on the podcast. And today we are going to be talking about something a little bit different to last time, which was stoicism, and that is loneliness. And before we go into more detail here with you, loneliness is something that everybody experiences time to time, probably more so with a pandemic, with lockdown rules and or the results of a pandemic, losing their job, losing their spouse, grief, what have you. So first of all, before we go into the definitions, why is loneliness a subject that has interested you over the years?
Yeah, I wrote a book called The Catholic Guide to Loneliness, and this was one of those books where I didn't proffer the idea myself. The publisher asked me to do it. I think it was back in 2016. Asked me to do it because of my background in clinical psychology. I have a doctorate in clinical psychology, most specifically in neuropsychology, like assessing dementias and brain damage and so forth. But anyway, the publisher asked me because he'd become aware of recent studies showing a really growing concern with loneliness. And again, this is in 2016, I believe he first approached me. So, you know, long before we had our lockdowns, that a number of studies around the world were showing this growing problem. They were talking about an upcoming epidemic of loneliness. I know for some reason they weren't using the term pandemic then that I came across, but epidemic came up quite a bit. And I found that some of the psychological journals, some of the professional journals in the mid-2010s were devoting entire issues to various articles on loneliness. How prevalent is it? Is there a genetic component? How much does it overlap with other mental conditions? You know, how does it affect mortality? So it's really, really a growing awareness there. So as I dug in preparing this book, you know, I wanted to really become conversant with the literature out there on the nature of loneliness, its prevalence, how it's been changing in recent decades and in recent years, and, you know, what can we do about it?
Loneliness is such a vague term because, you know, it's been thrown around time to time. But when we were talking off air via email, you highlighted the point, definitions of loneliness. So why don't you dissect that for us so we can understand it a bit more?
Sure. You know, and everyone, you know, has a basic intuitive understanding of loneliness, especially since most of us have probably felt it before. But one of the more common definitions amongst researchers and clinicians is to call it a perceived social isolation. And by perceived, it means it's your own take, your own interpretation of your own social situation. So people who are lonely, they're perceiving they're more isolated than they'd like to be. You know, that can vary person to person, how much contact you need. But the lonely person feels that they're more isolated than they want to be. They don't have adequate contacts. And sometimes they break this down into different levels. But the two fundamental levels that I've seen are, number one, sometimes called perceived emotional isolation. And this is a loneliness meaning that you feel you don't have close confidants, you know, dear friends, people you can really rely on and open your soul to. So this loneliness in terms of a lack of one-on-one intimacy with people that you'd like to have. And they often talk about a broader dimension of a perceived social isolation. Now, this could be a person who does have some good close friends or a close spouse or someone, and yet they feel they're kind of disconnected from broader groups. Like maybe they feel they don't work in, fit in their workplace or in school setting, or if they belong to a church or certain clubs. So they just feel kind of clubs. So they feel kind of socially isolated on a broader level. And a person can feel, you know, one or both. And many studies in recent decades have shown growing percentages of people experiencing loneliness in both of those domains.
So let's talk a bit more about emotional isolation. So I'm going to ask you questions like the basic person that I am, the average Joe, doesn't understand it to the same degree as you. So emotional isolation. So is that somebody who's like, oh, I feel sad because I'm isolated, or because I'm sad and I want to be away from other people?
Yeah, in this case, in terms of loneliness, it would typically be, you know, that I'm sad because I don't have those close relationships I'd like to. So right. This could be, you know, what any of us would experience after a breakup or the death of a loved one or maybe a divorce or something. So it's generally in terms of you would like to have these relationships, but you don't. Now, as loneliness prolongs, if it goes on for a long time, people tend to get distorted in their thought patterns. They tend to think maybe that if they reach out to people, they will be rejected. So in some people, it can develop into situations where they may want to be alone because they think people would reject them if they reached out. You know, so it can be expressed in different ways there. But I'll tell you, the most kind of basic fundamental issue, just this sense of emotional isolation. There was a very powerful study done in the United States of America, a longitudinal study, where they collected data about 20 years apart. Around 1985, University of Chicago queried thousands of people and asked them about the close confidants they had in their life. Like, you know, do you have people you can go to share important secrets, to ask for advice about important personal things? You know, people you consider confidants. And they asked people to tell them how many they had. And not just to generate some guess, they would say, can you give us their initials? You know, so we can pinpoint this. You really think about this. And the common choices were people would report they either had 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 and over. So those are the general categories. Now, in 1985, they found that the average number of confidants people reported was 3 close confidants in their life. And it could be, you know, a parent, it could be a spouse, it could be a friend, a variety of categories there. But that was the average person reported 3. About 20 years later, they repeated the study. And the average had gone from 3 to 2, which is not particularly telling maybe, but there were a few other stats that were even more telling. The modal response, which means the one that was given most often, you know, between those categories of 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 plus, the most common answer in 1985 was also 3. Hmm. But 20 years later, the most common of those categories was actually 0. It was given more than having 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 plus. And in the original study, 10%, you know, 1 person in 10 reported they had no confidants. 20 years later, that was 1 in 4, 25%. So that was really, really striking, this growing sense of isolation. The researchers also broke this down. You know, who are your confidants? Are they your parents? Are they your children? Are they coworkers? Are they neighbors? Are they people who belong to particular clubs? You know, is it your spouse? And they looked at all these categories separately. And many of these areas declined. Coworkers, neighbors, club members. The main ones that stayed steady were people's parents. And what even grew was spouse and family in general. So the general finding was people were more and more likely just to confide in close family members and less in other people of other relationships.
So for people who don't understand what a confidant is in the psychological term, is that somebody, so many of these terms are so loosely thrown about, oh, like he's my best friend, he's my rock, or she's my rock, whatever. But a confidant, is that somebody that you share your vulnerabilities with, or that your darkest secrets, or when you're, what is a confidant?
Sure, sure. And there would be overlap there with this idea of a close friend. And it could also be a family member. Just a person where, you know, if you were down, if you had some serious issue, if you had some serious problem, if you made some major mistake, you know, who would you go to? Who would you feel that would keep your trust, that would have your best interest in mind, that would help you through this? So it's that. It is like a best friend, but not just a friend you go and, you know, party with, but a friend that you really share your life with, and you try to help and bolster each other.
Well, that's really interesting you bring this up because, you know, people have so many different relationships. Some people have friendships that last a lifetime. Some people keep changing their friendships. Some people prioritize their family over friends. Some people prioritize their friends over family. In my case, one of my confidants was my father, and unfortunately he passed away to the coronavirus. Now, I've struggled with finding... So let's say my confidant was my father. I could tell him anything. I could trust him. I could rely on his wisdom, and for no circumstances of my own, but life itself and tragedy, that's been taken away from me. And I'm now in this sort of limbo where I think to myself, well, I've got people who I can talk to, but I don't have that confidant, that same level as a father or as a best friend. So how does somebody deal with that? And what do you advise in terms of, what do you advise, finding a new person? How does it work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm so sorry about your father. You know, my father passed away years ago. And yeah, there's some confidence that have, like that, that of course can never be completely replaced. They have a unique place in our lives. And thankfully, that's one thing that's been robust, is people, you know, do tend to keep their parents as their confidants when it's possible. But what do you do when the parent is gone? And yeah, this is a very central theme in a lot of the literature on, well, and even a lot of the classical literature on friendship. The ancient Roman Cicero, you know, wrote a classic treatise on friendship, and it's called the Laelius because he wrote it in the person of this man named Laelius. It was a dialogue. And the story starts where Laelius loses his closest confidant, a dear friend forever named Scipio. And and Laelius's two son-in-laws ask him to talk about what it was to be a friend of Scipio. And I think there's a lot of insights there, you know, at the loss of the dear confidant that can never be replaced. But many lessons there. Cicero says, for one thing, you know, he thanks God that he was able to have that relationship while he did. And he will always cherish his memory. You know, he will thank God that his friend was there for him. We can thank God that our parents were there for us and cherish that memory and try to live in such a way that we think they would want us to live, you know. So one thing that would involve trying to seek out new friendships. Here was Laelius with his sons-in-laws, trying to grow closer with them. So yeah, so hopefully we will be inspired by the loss of a dear confidant to eventually, you know, hopefully form dear confidential relationships with others. Though, of course, we have to be careful. Some people will kind of rebound and form new relationships with people. Maybe they'd be better off not, you know.
Well, we've got so many things to talk about. And the great thing about you, Kevin, is that you get me asking so many more questions. Well, that's good for me. I'm not sure if that's good for you. But that's an interesting thing that you say, rebounds. I mean, we'll go into friends and relationships and the differences in a moment. But trust, a lot of people might struggle with that because I'm a relatively trusting person. But at the same time, I've been burnt so many times by family, friends, you name it, narcissists, you name it. To the person who's listening to this now and is trying to overcome loneliness, or better yet, trying to understand it, how on earth can they rebuild their trust when all the time they've given their love, they've given their attention, they've given their secrets to these people only for it to be thrown back in their face?
Yeah, of course. And that's a legitimate concern. It's a real concern. And it does happen. And that's what we have to be careful, like with if loneliness is prolonged, it tends to distort our thinking, even our memory. So we tend to selectively focus on the people who have let us down, and all of us have had them. Probably we ourselves at times have let others down without maybe, you know, with or without knowing it. But we also want to remember that, you know, those narcissists, those people with sociopathic tendencies out there, they're real and they're out there. But they're outnumbered by people who, you know, at heart are fundamentally decent people and are looking after their own interests and would also like to see you thrive. So it is keeping open that it is possible to find people out there who will really care about us, and we can eventually trust them. But yeah, there needs to be a reasonable suspicion at first, so we don't, you know, open ourselves inappropriately and set ourselves up, you know, for some kind of a betrayal that causes us harm. So yeah, it's a very, you know, intricate process that would involve just, you know, reaching out very slowly. But I would say, yeah, a person who's been very burned needs to be careful at opening themselves up, you know, too intimately, too early.
So is that about learning about psychology then? How can they you know, if it's somebody who's suffered bullying or somebody who's, like you say, has been manipulated or been disrespected or attacked, whatever, you know, do they learn? How do they learn? What do they learn to protect themselves?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And when I was reviewing, you know, the research on loneliness, so in terms of the clinical, what are they doing about it now? Mm-hmm. And I found a few, you know, meta-analyses, which are statistical studies where they take a group of previous studies and try to find ones that fit certain criteria. Then they employ statistical analyses to treat these multiple little studies as if they were one big one. But one of the most recent, the best I came across, kind of categorize three main approaches for dealing with people with loneliness, trying to help them. Uh-huh. And one was, you know, where therapists might actually try to encourage them to actually join some kind of affiliations or clubs or some kind of support group to actually just join and belong to something. Another tactic is social skills training, which is applicable to some people. Some people who are lonely may be reluctant to make eye contact with other people, you know, or to reach out to others, to say hi, to acknowledge when they're there, to take small risks in interaction. So social skill training is another approach. But the one they found most successful has tended to be variants of cognitive therapy, which again kind of goes back to those old Stoic ideas that we control the way we see the world. So they say one of the most fundamental important attributes of prolonged loneliness is what they called maladaptive social cognition. Maladaptive social cognition. People who are lonely for a long, long time tend to get that selective memory. They're over hesitant. They expect to be rejected, you know, and sometimes they will be. So some of the best methods are, again, very akin to those old Stoic methods of training people to look accurately on how people interact with them and not to overact, not to think that the slightest thing, you know, a sense of rejection or a slight from others is really that. Look and see the real situation. But also to steel oneself to acknowledge the fact that sometimes when you reach out, yes, somebody is going to rebuff you or they're not going to care, or they're not going to acknowledge you. But to train in yourself that you can accept that also. And I think another aspect of this would be if you have this perceived social isolation, I'd like to be more connected than I am. Another part of the cognitive therapy and the Stoic approach is that you also train yourself that you can endure it while you need to. Mm-hmm. You know, saying, I can take this. I'd like to have more relationships than I do, and I don't, but I can endure it, and I can live as good a life as I can without those relationships. But over time, I will try and see if I can reestablish some.
Based on your research, which you're a man who goes into a lot of detail with your research, and it's why I'm a huge fan of yours, I want to know if you ever found any sort of correlation with introverted. Did you research personality, first of all? That's my question. Did personality play a big part in your study on loneliness? When I say personality, I'm talking about introverts and extroverts. Did you find more introverts suffered loneliness, or was it actually the opposite?
Well, here, yeah. And that particular personality distinction, I don't recall in the recent literature that there was a vast amount looking at those personality traits, but what it comes closest to, in one way, like things like social anxiety disorder, you know, people who are very, very, fearful of interacting with others mm-hmm. can be prone for loneliness. People who are depressed, you know, of course, are less likely to reach out. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of overlap there. But there's also, you know, kind of some weaknesses and strengths there with the different personality types, mm-hmm. because there's also a body of literature, you know, pointing out how some people who are more introverted, you know, more into themselves, more into ideas, sometimes they have some strength and resiliency in dealing with loneliness because they can be more content without a whole lot of external stimulation. Mm. Again, there's a British psychiatrist, Anthony Storr. He wrote a book called Solitude in 1988. And he was pointing out that it was in the 1940s and 50s, this psychoanalyst, Frieda Fromm Reichman, was writing about the phenomenon of loneliness, you know, growing in our modern culture. But he said at the same time, a man, Donald Winnicott, another analyst, was writing about the capacity to be alone as a positive thing, that we can harness that. So, you know, throughout history, we have tons of examples in the secular world and in the religious world of people who have really profited from periods of being alone, of actual solitude, in several different categories. One, for example, is people who've been in enforced solitude against their will. And just to give a couple examples there, there were people throughout history who have been imprisoned, who achieved good things while there. The philosopher Boethius in the kind of the Dark Ages was imprisoned before he died and wrote The Consolation of Philosophy, a wonderful book. St. Thomas More was in the Tower of London there under King Henry VIII and wrote a wonderful book called The Sadness of Christ, you know, during his imprisonment. When I think of sometimes is St. Patrick, you know, who came somewhere from the British Isle there, but was captured by Irish pirates, spent almost 7 years of his youth in isolation, up, you know, herding sheep and things. And that's where he had his religious conversion. So there's all kinds of, and in the secular world too, Alexander Solzhenitsyn,
In the Gulag, right? He was in the Gulag.
And I have to realize that Dostoevsky before him, you know, a century or so before him, had been in prison for a time, so.
Kevin, what is friendship? We hear it so many, it's thrown around all the time. This is my best friend, this is my BFF, this is my friend, they're my friend, they're my friend. But what is friendship in an age of social media, in an age of narcissism? When I say narcissism, people are using other people and, you know, they just feel validation. What is true friendship?
Yeah, and for there, you know, I go first for my answer to Aristotle. He's given us some of the most explicit, you know, insightful writings on friendship in his Nicomachean Ethics, the books or chapters 8 and 9. And one thing he made, this wonderful little scheme that just makes so much common sense when I talk to people about this, like, oh yeah, I can see that. And one thing he talks about is three different kinds or classes of friendship. And he talks about one as friendships of utility or use. Now, in the extreme, yeah, these can be friendships where people are just using us, right? They say you're, you know, a friend, but you find out later they're just using you. When you're no longer useful, you know, there you go. You're no longer, you know, part of their inner circle. But Aristotle said can be a positive element of friendship that's based upon utility or use. The fact that friends are also often helpful for each other. So different times in our life, you know, we might form a friendship, but maybe we're going through school and we form some kind of study group where we can help each other. Or you're new on some job and there's other apprentices there with you and you help each other. You know, you're useful to each other. So he said there is some element of friendship there that we've all probably experienced where we're helpful to each other. But it's very, very limited because, yeah, when the person is no longer useful, often that friendship will end. Also, some people with the more pathological personalities will take advantage of that use. But a second category he calls friendships of pleasure. And certainly we all have this. This is friends that we get together and we go out and party, or maybe we participate in a certain sport or do other things that we just enjoy with each other. We enjoy that person's, you know, sense of humor maybe, or the fact that we have common interests. So friendships of pleasure, he said, are very, very, very common. He said they're really characteristics of the friendships we form as children, right? Because we play together. We just enjoy things together. And he said, you know, that can be a good thing. But if a friendship is based only on pleasure, then what happens when your friend maybe has hard times? He can't do the things he used to. Maybe he's become depressed. He's not as witty. He's not as fun. Do we maintain that friendship or do we let it go because, you know, they no longer provide us pleasure? So it's a very limited form of friendship. But he talks about the one true highest form of friendship, which Aristotle calls friendships of excellence or virtue. And he said here, you know, a main characteristic of this kind of friendship, it's ideally said, is when you're considering the friend, your virtuous friend, another self. And he said that a true friendship is when we take that natural love that we have for ourselves. You know, like we want to live, we want to exist, we want good things to come to ourselves. We actually take actions to make good things come to ourselves. You know, we experience pleasure when things go well for us and so on. And he says that's when we can apply that kind of love to another person. You know, and we want so much not necessarily to get a benefit from them, but to be able to give a benefit to them. He said, this is a true kind of friendship. When each person is considering the other one as a second self, when you're concerned about that person's welfare, he even says how this fans out. You know, if you have a friend you truly, truly love, he says, chances are you're going to like or have warm feelings for their other close friends or for their family members, because even the things that radiate from them, you're going to care about. So anyway, according to Aristotle, you know, the highest form of friendship is this friendship built on virtue, where you try to lift each other up, where you truly care about each other. But Aristotle, writing in ancient Greece, said, though, he said, because virtue is so rare, these kind of friendships are also very rare.
My father, God rest his soul, used to always say this to me. You should count your friends on your hand, like on one hand. Do you agree with that?
I believe I do. I believe I see where your father's coming in terms of close friends.
Yeah, because that's what I meant. Yeah, sorry, not yes. Everybody. Yeah, close friends. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, one thing we could say that there's a virtue of friendliness or affability. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, in a sense, we owe it to every person we come across. Mm-hmm. You know, we're friendly, but we cannot become true, deep friends with every person, because that also requires, you know, proximity and time in their presence. Aristotle writes about this extensively, too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's only so many friends, you know, maybe a handful, that we can really devote the time and energy it takes to develop that kind of a deep relationship. So I certainly agree with the wisdom of your father there, that, you know, while we can be friendly to every person we meet, we really only have the time and capacity and energy to develop these, you know, intimate friendships, to develop true confidants, you know, with a limited number of people at any one time in our life.
What about relationships, Kevin? And when I say relationships, we talk about romantic relationships now. So a spouse, a partner, a wife, husband, a living partner, whatever. What about loneliness in relation to relationships? I mean, you know, what if somebody is desperate for that? I know you're going to take a very stoic approach. I know the answer to this maybe already, but, you know, enlighten me. What about someone is very desperate for a relationship, but they can't find that person that fits the, not the dream scenario, but the person that understands them, wants what's best for them, accommodates their life, and, you know, makes as much of an effort as that person is, you know, in, you know, like, let's say this person who feels lonely wants to have a serious relationship, wants to get married potentially, and all he or she is doing is going out there and finding riffraff and people who are not quite right, and they're trying to make it work with the wrong people. What is the correct philosophy or way of thinking in association to that type of loneliness and romantic relationships?
Yeah, that is a very important question. And yeah, you're right. I'll go stoic on that to some extent. It's Lucilius Rufus is one of the Stoics who talks the most about the beauty of human relationships and of marriage and of our natural desire there. And even Aristotle himself, you know, he's famous for defining humans as, you know, the rational animal, and also as the political animal, that we form a polis, or the, you know, associations with others. But even Aristotle says that even more fundamental than this political drive is the connubial drive, or the drive for a relationship between spouses. So it's just deeply ingrained in our nature, and it's a good thing. And when Aristotle writes about friendship, he patterns the truest, dearest friendships after relationships, like the ideal that hopefully you'd find between a husband and wife, and between parents and their children. So the need there, you know, the need there is real. Oh, and this brings another idea in mind from the research on modern research on loneliness. Mm-hmm. Some of it coming from an evolutionary perspective. They say loneliness in some sense is a good thing. It's a signal. It's like hunger or thirst. Mm. You know, it triggers us that, yes, we are made for relationships. So that sense of loneliness ideally will be a motivator. But then what do we do in the real world? You know, you don't have a deep relationship. You want one. Well, that's where the Stoic principles to come in, to endure and persevere, bear and forbear, even if it takes a long time. But I think we do need to, you know, have some sense of hope and trust, that keep our eyes open and don't rule people out, expose ourselves in a variety of situations to potential mates and not give up. You know, there are times when a person might be seeking someone for years and years and be hopeless, and all of a sudden that one day comes, you know, and there's that person. And that sense of hopelessness is gone. You know, you can replace it with a sense of gratitude. So I think we can all, you know, hope for that. If we don't have a deep, intimate relationship now, don't give up hope that one is possible. While at the same time, you know, keeping in mind that you can endure life. You still can have some joy in life while you're searching. And maybe, Stephen, maybe here's an essential point. that applies to relationships and loneliness in general. Because it's kind of the great irony of loneliness, right? You know, like so the John Lennon song, All of the Lonely People. You know, and studies are now finding, you know, maybe a third of the people in our Western cultures are significantly lonely. So everywhere around us, you know, we're out there looking for a soulmate. There's someone else is looking too, you know. So we need to be aware of that, that we're not the only ones in that situation. There are other people there. So it's worth the pursuit because other people are striving for the same thing that we are.
There are online communities and cults, in some cases. I'm not saying that they're all cults. Men who go their own way, women who go their own way. Cults of people who have had experiences, or maybe they haven't, of where they feel, I don't need to have a spouse, I don't need to have friends. There's a popular internet saying for people who like to go nofap, which is to not masturbate for a certain period of time, where they go into monk mode, which is where they cut themselves off from society. And in my personal experience, not that I've ever belonged to these groups, but I've always read what they're preaching. I've got a very open mind. I find that that doesn't really help, because I feel there's sometimes people going through periods of solitude and loneliness. So, for example, their life was super busy. They were in a very exciting job, or they had a partner that they were happy with, and they had a really busy social life. And then life has happened, e.g. a pandemic, whatever, and they're suddenly thrown out of the realms of their normality into a new type of reality, where maybe they're going through a divorce, whatever, so they're at a little bit of a bitter stage. So what do you think of these online communities and groups of people, which is ironic really, because they're groups of people together, but also they're groups sort of, what's the word, encouraging solitude more so than socializing?
Yeah, now that's an interesting phenomenon. I'm not too aware of it myself, of the, you know, the internet component of that. But, you know, there's a long history of like people who had become anchorites or hermits, you know, in the Christian tradition, or in the Russians, the Starzy, the Starets, that would go out and kind of live in the woods there. And there's a lot of this in the Christian tradition too, the desert fathers, people who would go away for a time. And I think for a person who's actually going to live the majority of their life in solitude is going to be pretty rare. There was a book written in 1996. Francis. I'm going to actually look up the title to make sure I get this.
Okay, sure.
I don't want to rob him of his correct name. And but it's a book about hermits. Let's see, is it John Francis maybe? Here we go. All right, I'm going to have it in a second here. Yeah, Peter France, 1996, wrote a book called Hermits, The Insights of Solitude. And I remember it said, and he's given the history of hermits, you know, who sought this, how long did they stay hermits, what benefits did they get? And he described himself as a sometime hermit. And to me, that idea that at certain times of your life, you might choose solitude, you know, go off somewhere, have limited social interaction, I think can be a good thing. But to me, ideally, not with the idea that you're always going to stay that way. But in your period of solitude, you're going to get what he says, insights, that then eventually you're going to carry back out into the world with you. My own namesake in the Christian world, St. Kevin of Glendalough, Scotland. He is one of those ancient 5th or 6th century saints. And his story was, he lives as a hermit for 7 years in this Glen of Two Lakes in Wicklow County, Ireland, until through a series of events, he was brought out and led to form a monastery. So his example was, here's a man drawn to isolation, but he also, it was going to serve a purpose. He was later going to come out and reach out to people and teach them spiritual lessons. But even the story of Kevin, St. Kevin, if you see a depiction of him, he's usually sitting there with a blackbird resting in one of his palms. And the story was, you know, even when he had come out of his hermit phase and led this monastery as its abbot, during Lent, he would still go out in the woods for like sometimes up to 40 days and just live in little huts And one day he's in one of these huts and his hand is sticking out the window when he's praying in the open-armed fashion. And a blackbird lands on his palm. And this, the legend has it that Kevin sees this. The blackbird lays some eggs and he just stands there until the eggs open and the birds are able to fly away. You know, so it's an interesting little story. But the general insight, though, is that, you know, even certain people would be more drawn to solitude. But hopefully even those people, they're going to gather insights there that they're going to come out there and share with other people. But then at times they may feel drawn to go back for periods of time to kind of like recharge their batteries in chosen periods of solitude again.
So what about the people all around the world right now who have had imposed solitude? They might be listening in a huge house. They might be listening in a studio flat. They might be listening in worse circumstances, unfortunately. And, you know, I wish you all safety and health. Mm-hmm. So the lockdown, what about people who have never experienced loneliness or have dabbled in it but have kept their lives so perfectly composed, that when I say composed, that they've got a busy, full, fulfilling life, that suddenly that's all taken away from them from this pandemic, you know, once in a generation experience? What about those people?
Yeah, boy, isn't that a tough question, and an unexpected one. You know, a year ago, who could imagine that you'd be asking me something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, terrifying. Yeah.
This lockdown, this imposed, you know, to some extent, exposed isolation on a great number of us. Now, I thought about this again recently. I meant to look it up to see if I'm accurate or not, but I haven't yet. But if I remember right, you know, the French philosopher Voltaire, his little farcical story Candide, I think near the end he talks about something about his lesson in life being to kind of tend your own garden, you know, to take care of what's right around you within your actual sphere of influence. And I think one thing that I know my wife and I, we've almost taken that literally during this lockdown, when we've not been able to get out as much, but we're taking more care of the nature around us. We happen to have a yard with many features to take care of. We do that. We're improving the house. I'm a weightlifter, so I kind of made a home gym in my garage and built that up. So I guess the idea is, if you're locked down, you have more limited social interactions, if you have other passions, other interests, other things you can focus on, do that. You know, things that you would have neglected, now take care of. And I'm sure many people are already doing this. But also, I hope we're also taking some time to reflect, because hopefully we have maybe a little more time now than we used to think, you know, what are we going to do when the world is more back to normal, when we can get out and socialize? Have we learned any lessons here? Maybe we've learned to realize the vulnerability of the older people in our lives, that you know, they may not be with us long, the ones who have survived this pandemic. Can we show more care for them? So I think that would be my main fundamental lessons. What can we do within our limited sphere? And then what lessons can we learn that we're going to apply when we're let loose upon the world again?
And can we also stress that this is temporary, right? Life will resume back to normal.
Oh, exactly. That's a very important point too, Stephen, that you know, we can endure it as long as we need to endure it, but it is temporary, yes. And at that point, you know, as we had this unexpected lockdown, we're also going to experience this freedom again that we haven't had for a long time. So we need to be prepared, you know, well, now how are we going to make the best of that? And then hopefully, I would hope in this time of imposed loneliness, hopefully we can be a little bit more aware of the loneliness that's already out there, the loneliness in people who were lonely before this lockdown ever happened, and maybe just make us a little more aware of their existence and a little more likely to reach out to them.
Let me give you my experience. For the last, since around September last year, a lot of changes happened. I ended a relationship, and that was for a couple of years. It wasn't sudden, it was a gradual thing. I also cut ties with a very close friend of mine, extremely close. Mm. And we've started talking again because, you know, since the tragedy of my father, we rekindled and it will never be the same again. But I experienced sort of like a self-imposed isolation, because I've been a very extroverted person. I really do like people. I get this from my father. My dad was an extrovert. He loved people. He worked in an industry for many years where he was meeting hundreds of people every day and talking to them. He loved people. And deep down, I did too. But something happened and I just felt like, not bitter, but I felt, do you know what? Because I suffered with a, I couldn't bear to be alone because I thought if I was alone, then I would just dwell on everything that's gone wrong in my life. I'd be alone with my thoughts, and that'd be quite scary. And then something sort of triggered for me the last year or so that I was alone in a relationship. And when I say alone, like I never was heard, I was never really truly appreciated, I never really was loved the way that I should have been. And as a result of that, I kind of got to know me better as a person. And I realized that the relationship was making me worse. It's kind of a long story short. I imposed my own isolation. So I was doing things alone. I was going to town. When I say town, I mean central London, and going to shops and places that I liked to, which I was doing in my relationship alone now. I was eating out alone. I was going to the movies alone. And it felt strange. There were some times where I was a little bit, you know, what am I doing here? I'm alone here, like that. But at other times I was thinking, well, this is just a phase. And I'm also grieving the breakup. I'm grieving, you know, the loss of my friend. And but I'm not going to stop living my life, even if it means that I'm alone. But I worry and I fear. So this is a very long-winded question. I worry and fear, Kevin, that that might just be the new normal for me, where it's like, well, I might be eternally, God forbid, going to cinemas alone and eating out alone and stuff like that. Or is it just the phase? I'd love to get your view on it. Sorry if it's a bit long-winded.
Oh, no, no, I appreciate that. I'm just trying to rein it in now. That triggered so many possible responses here. Let me just start here and see where we're going. Before I start, I'd say probably, I don't know for sure, but that temporary that we applied to the lockdown is probably applies to your situation too. I mean, time will tell. Mm-hmm. But I think too, about that loneliness, you're talking about going places alone and doing things that maybe in the past you wouldn't have done. I'm not sure if you're, let me start here. One of the big modern researchers on loneliness has done a lot of presentations. I remember him saying that when he gives his talks among big groups, he would always ask for a show of hands of people who have been lonely at some point in their life. And he said, it's usually virtually every hand goes up. And then he says, okay, he goes, how many of you are lonely right now? And he says, there's virtually never a hand that goes up because there is such a stigma, you know, that if I'm lonely, maybe that means there's something wrong with me. Mm. People don't want to be around me, right? People don't like me. I don't know if you're old enough, if you've ever heard or remember, there was a movie, a comedy Steve Martin did called The Lonely Guy.
Okay. No, I've never heard of it. No.
Okay, well, to get a sense of this, I haven't watched it in years, but I just remember there's one classic scene. He goes to a restaurant and he goes there and they said, you know, how many, you know, in your party? And he's kind of whispers, you know, one, you know, we're like just me. And when he does that, the person picks up a microphone and calls out to everyone, table for just him, you know. And then a big spotlight comes on him and everybody you know, follows him as he sits down there by himself, and everybody around him, of course, is with other people and having conversations and all that, you know. So I need to rewatch that to see how he resolved it. But it does highlight, though, that there can be that stigma that people who are alone, you know, are afraid to be seen that way. So I think one thing, if you are feeling lonely, if you're able to go out there and do things by yourself, that's a good thing. I remember my own youth having some feelings of loneliness, and I would virtually never go out to a restaurant by myself until later when I, when an adult, would go places to do talks and things. So it's just by myself. And it so it got to be a point where I didn't care. But I do remember being younger and actually being very, very self-conscious about that. So I think it's, you know, probably not unusual today. People will feel that way. So, but if you can go out and do things by yourself while you don't have close confidence, I think that's a very, very good thing, but probably a temporary thing. You know, probably at times too, there'll be new relationships formed, but hopefully you've also gained from that capacity to be alone when you are alone. I think of a phrase here, I always go back to the Stoics, from Seneca. And, you know, the Stoic sage was like the perfect person in a sense. And they think nobody really on earth really quite got there. Maybe Socrates was really close. They had a few other examples, Cato, the Roman, a few examples. But according to the Stoic sage is going to be self-sufficient. You know, they want to live a life of virtue, and they don't necessarily have to have outside things. Well, then someone says, would a Stoic sage then, why would he seek friendships? And Seneca said, well, technically, the Stoic sage is self-sufficient. He doesn't have to have friends, but he's still going to prefer to have them if he can. And then Seneca says, too, he says, and don't necessarily seek a friend to have someone to comfort you when you're down or come see you when you're sick. He said, find a friend so you can comfort them when they're down, or you can go to them when they're sick. So I just think that there's just a lot of beauty in the idea of striving for friendships if we can, using them to benefit others, but also knowing that we can take it during periods where we don't have intimate friendships.
Well, let's thank you for that. Let's talk about some important points here in studies. So tell me about the studies on the spread of loneliness like a pandemic.
Sure. And this was, you know, maybe over the last couple decades or so now, this has been a growing awareness that, like in the United States, the big society for retired persons is the AARP, the American Association of Retired People. You know, those are the mostly older people, but they did a study and found about a third of their respondents or so said they were significantly lonely. Many other groups have done this at many other age ranges. Let me see. Just to give some practical examples. Now, my book on loneliness came out in the fall of 2017. I remember not long after that, a friend of mine sent me an article. It showed where the American Surgeon General had some big announcement about loneliness. I believe it was a few months later over in England, Theresa May appointed a minister of loneliness because in the UK, you know, it was recognized that loneliness was widespread and it was causing issues and problems. Last year, I was contacted by a Catholic newspaper in Melbourne, Australia, to talk about loneliness. And before I did that, I looked at their data. In Australia, it was a growing phenomenon. Just a couple months ago, I did an interview for a Vancouver, British Columbia, Canadian paper, and the stats were there. It's in Canada, so it's everywhere. And one of the reasons it's such a concern is some of the studies have looked at loneliness, prolonged loneliness, as a predictor of mortality. Mm. People who are lonely, seriously lonely for a long time, tend not to live as long. In fact, it's been compared, and it's the strength of the effect, it's been compared to obesity and even to smoking. So it's a serious problem, especially later in life, that it's kind of those, you know, the interpersonal context, the ability to confide in a person, the ability to feel you're connected in some way, you know, makes us more psychologically healthy and tends to prolong our lives. So it's, in a sense, it's a public health risk if loneliness, you know, continues to grow as it has.
Yeah, well, please, can you tell me more about the deadliness of loneliness, you know, the negative signs of it, like you say?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I haven't looked at the data in a while, but I know some studies compared it, loneliness to other particular things they looked at was, you know, reporting that you're lonely. And some studies will just say, you know, are you lonely or have you been lonely in such a period of time? There's also particular scales that they sometimes use, a more in-depth look at loneliness so you can judge it, you know, how severe is it and so on. But I remember one of the studies compared, you know, self-reported loneliness to, you know, actually being isolated, actually living alone and having little contact. And I'm trying to think, there's one other thing that they compared it to. But loneliness itself, the feeling of loneliness, was just as high a mortality risk factor as actually living in an isolated way. I mean, so just that psychological perception was significant. And when they compare it to other risk factors, they're comparing it to things like obesity, smoking, you know, hypertension. So why would that be? Why would the prolonged loneliness be a risk factor? Well, you know, one, there's approximately 50% overlap between, you know, loneliness and major depression. Kind of a distinction is, you know, a lonely person may only feel down and sad about their social relationships. A person with full-blown depression feels down and sad about self, others, the world, the future, just about everything. So people who are severely lonely, maybe about half of those are also depressed. And if people who are severely depressed, a certain portion of them are also lonely. But so there's psychological consequences. And so if it leads to depression, depression is also linked to higher incidence of heart disease and other physical ailments. But also they found that, you know, when people have prolonged loneliness, they're less likely to take care of themselves physically. For example, they might, in terms of their eating or drinking, they may go towards comfort foods. Say, I'm not around anybody. They lose concern about the way they look, so maybe they'll develop very poor dietary habits, and which impairs their physical health. Or they'll turn to drink or drink more heavily, tend towards alcoholism or possibly, drug addiction. So people who have prolonged loneliness, if their thinking gets distorted for a long time, it may also lead to other specific behaviors that are, deleterious to our health and longevity. So it's kind of one part of a complex problem. Prolonged loneliness can lead to these other psychological and actual, physical impairments.
Yeah, so it's very, very important that we clarify this because there is a fundamental difference. Because again, there's a lot of BS out there on the internet, what people say as well. So, loneliness and mental health and depression, or mental illness and depression, are two very, very different things. Correct, Kevin?
Yes. In fact, as I was preparing, I was looking through the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, the latest edition. And unless I'm mistaken, there is no diagnosis of loneliness as a psychiatric impairment. And also, even in the symptom checklist for different disorders, I believe loneliness was not really even found there. So if you feel we're lonely, it does not necessarily indicate that you have a mental disorder. No, they can be two very, very different things because, it's a perceived isolation. Well, your perception might be pretty darn accurate, It might be very, very accurate. So yeah, loneliness itself is not necessarily a mental disorder, but we have to be careful if it's let to go unchecked. In some people over time, it may lead to distortions of thought that can lead us towards a disorder. So something to be careful about is a distinction I make too in my book that, it's not saying that everybody who's lonely needs to go seek professional help, seek a therapist, help from a therapist or some or a medical doctor. But if a person is lonely and they've tried to alleviate on themselves and it's still impairing them, and if they feel it's leaking into other areas of their life, if it's impacting their ability to work or and other things like that, then it may well be worth notifying a health professional about it. Because most lonely people will not do that.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I'm sorry to backtrack a little bit, but it's something I've been dying to ask you. What about people that are lonely or feel alone in relationships? Like you're dating a toxic person, or you're not with the right partner, or you've got a best friend that doesn't hear you, doesn't listen to you. What about those people who are alone? They're with people in a very close proximity, but they're alone and they feel lonely.
Oh, that phenomenon, of course, is so real. I remember that the old Stoic Musonius Rufus, first century AD, he talks about that within marriages, saying how beautiful a marriage can be, but how difficult it can be if that person within the marriage is not listened to, is not respected and heard. So that is a very real phenomenon. The same applies to crowds. A person can be within a vast crowd and feel very, very lonely. Or a person can have a relationship. They can have a person there, maybe they've been in a relationship for years or married to for years, and still feel lonely. So yes, that is very real, because here's where that perceived emotional isolation might again be genuine. That person, is not seeing you as a second self. Maybe they're using you or only interested in certain aspects. So that's real, and it can certainly be accurate, and it does put a person, in a quandary, if they're in a relationship where this is going on, that would call forth, what can I do to bear it, to endure it, but what can I possibly do to change it? What can I possibly do to get that person to treat me differently? And then if they don't, you decide what you're going to do from that point.
Is it like an addiction? Like, are people, I was a gambling addict, so I never admitted it until I actually beat my problem. But I said, I was addicted to gambling. So is it, do people need to say, hey, I'm addicted to loneliness. I have a problem with being lonely. Is that important for them to admit that to themselves and to a confidant or somebody?
Yes. There can be that sense where you're addicted to it, or you're thinking that this is just my lot in life, and this is going to last forever. This is how I am. It's good, if people, if they have a friend they can confide in, just admit their loneliness. Because if about a third of the population is significantly loneliness, about a third of the time that person might let you know that, that they're in the same boat. You know, it's very possible. But yeah, and it impacts our relationships. You know, sometimes people who are lonely, it will lead them to, you know, to jump in relationships that are harmful to them. And of course, there's all these kind of dynamics with relationships. I always remember one thing from, you mentioned personalities earlier and personality disorders, that sometimes it said that people with different, strikingly different personalities, it's often that that different thing about that person that first draws you in, that you find so fascinating, that's later the thing that drives you apart from that person. An example that used to be given was, like take maybe a male who tends to be towards more obsessive compulsive, everything very ordered, very structured, very planned, and then maybe they come across a young woman who is very much the opposite. At the pathological level, this, we call this histrionic, very superficial. Nothing bothers them. Everything's a show. You know, everything's something to laugh about. You know, and they, those two might be drawn to each other. You know, he loves that spontaneity. She admires that sense of order, which she doesn't have, you know. But if they come together and if they don't grow, if they don't, you know, if he doesn't grow in spontaneity or she doesn't grow in some order from him, then it can come to the, that those things that drew them together later will be the things that most irritate them about each other and might drive them apart.
What are the methods of psychological therapy that are happening right now with loneliness?
Yeah, and again, you know, one is social skills training. A person who's lonely or not very well connected, doesn't have many friends, he might, you know, engage in teaching them how to make eye contact, how to do introductions and all. And I will say, I recently gave a talk where I pointed out that that this is not the main method now, because most lonely people already do have these skills. But it was brought to my attention, there was actually a person in that room, a young adult, who was going through exactly that kind of training to make eye contact, because they didn't, you know, and to, you know how to introduce and greet people. So that can play a role. We shouldn't really just assume that everyone already knows how to do those social interactions. So maybe we come across a person who seems very awkward, who doesn't make eye contact with us. Well, you know, maybe then we can take those extra steps to make them feel welcome, to make them feel comfortable. So, but that's one area, though, the social skills. The main one, though, tends to be that trying to attack those maladaptive social cognitions or kind of distorted views of the world that lonely people might get, where they're too likely to expect people to reject them if they reach out, and where they're more likely to keep ruminating on past times in their lives when maybe they've lost a loved one, or when someone has, you know, betrayed them or rebuffed them or slighted them and so on. So a big part of the psychological approach tends to be this, you know, the cognitive reframing, to look at the world differently. And I talk about kind of three main positive effects that can come from that, that kind of retraining. And one is that it can help us attack that maladaptive social thinking. So we're thinking in more realistic ways, so we're not so upset about our loneliness. When we use this kind of cognitive therapy, it can also make us more aware if we are developing habits, you know, overeating, drinking too much, you know, being promiscuous, whatever, to try to combat the loneliness. So it can help us rein ourselves in that way. And also, you know, if we change our thinking, it can just kind of help us bear that loneliness while it endures. You know, hoping it's not permanent, but telling ourselves, even if it is, you know, we can still endure. We can still have meaningful, fulfilling lives.
I'm really interested in this, even though you've touched on it a few times in our talk, the potential benefits of solitude. Famous examples throughout history and how we can gain such benefits today. I'm really intrigued by this, so go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, and I'll go back a little bit to the British psychiatrist Anthony Storr's 1988 book on solitude. He gives some examples here, and one, he says, you know, that There's individual differences, you know, like the introverts and the extroverts. Some of us have a greater desire for contacts than others. And we don't need to say that there's something wrong with a person who doesn't want a whole lot of friends, or the introvert doesn't need to think there's something wrong with a person who does want to be with a lot of friends. There's the continuum there of differences. And I remember one example he gives is the British historian Edward Gibbon, who wrote that magnificent Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And apparently, you know, he severely curtailed his social life because he was so into this project. It was so fulfilling to him. And then he gave the world a pretty magnificent work by doing that. He goes on to give examples that we mentioned briefly about people who are imprisoned against their will. I think Sir Walter Scott is another example he gives of a person who was in prison and wrote a great history. We move on into the Christian tradition. I mentioned that St. Kevin in Ireland, we had the Desert Fathers who purposefully, you know, went out alone for long periods of time. Probably my favorite extreme example in Christian history. I know, Stephen, if you've ever come across St. Simeon Stylites.
No, I haven't. No.
I believe that Stylites was from the Greek. It means like a pole or a pillar. And he was a man, when was it? Maybe the 4th or 5th century AD, who was a hermit who basically lived on top of a series of pillars with a platform. I think the highest one they said was up to 38 feet tall. And he basically lived most of his life up there with, I guess people would come to him and with a system of ropes or pulleys, and they would give him his food and take down the waste, you know. But he actually spent years atop of this pillar, just in deep meditation and prayer, and then people would kind of come to him and revered him as a holy man. You know, so there's one of my favorite examples. But within the Christian tradition, there are all kinds of examples of different saints who went out in the wilderness for limited amounts, varying amounts of time. There's also examples of some of the great saints who just took limited time, often earlier in their lives, for chosen solitude. One example is the Italian St. Catherine of Siena. She was a young woman who was never formally learned to even train to read and write. According to the legends, she was given this in a gift and a special mystical vision. She spent about 3 years in her parents' home, leaving almost for no other reason to go to Mass, you know, deep in solitude and prayer. And then when she came out, she was like this social dynamo. She's this uneducated young woman. She wasn't even formally a religious sister, but she was writing letters to popes and influencing popes and doing all this work for the poor and hospital, just kind of a real mover and shaker. But they say what got her started was these 3 years of preparation in prayer and contemplation. In Peru, there's the revered saint, Saint Rosa of Lima, patterned her life after Saint Catherine of Siena, and said she spent years in prayer in a little shed in her backyard. They say it was about the size of a closet before she came out and did great social works. And another one is a recent man named a doctor, a great teacher in the Catholic Church, a John of Avila. And it said also of him, in his, I believe his early 20s, he returned to his parents' home, spent about 3 years mostly in his room in prayer, meditation, and study and contemplation, and before he then came out and did great things. So another point in the Francis book on hermits, he talked about this Russian tradition of what they call the Starcy or Starets, these elders who would go out into the wilderness and be like a hermits. But he said often they'd be out there in the wilderness and people would seek them out for their guidance. And I believe in Dostoevsky's book, The Brothers Karamazov, there's one of these that I haven't read in so many years, I don't remember the details, but there's one of these where people go out and seek their wisdom. So people who are living in the world would go to these hermits out in the wilderness and ask them advice about their relationships, about their problems. So I think we saw here this recognition that sometimes people who can train themselves to be around the hubbub of the world, you know, can gather insights that could be helpful to us who are out in the world and helpful to those hermit-like people when they have periods when they decide to come back into society.
Tell me about the lowliness of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, you know, and again, when I wrote this book, it was for a Catholic publisher, you know, Christian Catholic publisher. And I said my goal was to use Catholic in two senses. One is the small C, coming from the word that just means universal. So I wanted to look at psychology. I wanted to look everywhere. But also I wanted to give a specifically Catholic approach because of my publisher, you know, a Christian Catholic approach. And all Christians look, of course, to Christ, you know, the founder, the you know, God made man. And this is where there's an interesting intersection. Because some of my main insights on Christ's own loneliness came from a book written by St. Thomas More when he was in prison in the Tower of London. And he wrote a book, the title in brief is The Sadness of Christ. This book really is the sadness and this, that, and the other thing. It just goes on, all these different aspects of Christ. But one of his fundamental insights there was that even Jesus Christ, you know, God himself, but as he took on a human nature, said in his human nature, he experienced loneliness. You know, obviously upon the cross. But one other example that St. Thomas More really focuses on is Jesus' night of prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, before he's betrayed and before he's, you know, hung on the cross. And, you know, he goes out there to pray, if people don't remember the story, and he's not far away. He just goes like a stone's throw away from three of his absolute best friends, Peter, James, and the beloved disciple, John. And he asks them, you know, just to stay awake for him, you know, while he's there praying. And he comes back a short time later. He's greatly distressed. He sees they've fallen asleep. He asks him to stay awake. He's going to go back and pray a little more. You know, he does it again. Christ is in such stress in his humanity over knowing what's coming. This is even sweats blood. But basically, he comes back, and three times his three of his best friends have let him down. You know, well, what's happening in the meanwhile? Another man who said he was Christ's friend, Judas, was wide awake, of course, but he was plotting Jesus' destruction. So then, you know, then there in the garden, here comes Judas, you know, with other people and soldiers. And tellingly, Christ's first word to him is, you know, he calls Judas his friend, because he had, of course, offered his friendship to him. And yet Judas, you know, who portrayed himself as a true virtuous friend of Christ, was really quite the friend of use or utility, of course, because he's making actually money now off of betraying Jesus. So St. Thomas More, you know, asks us to imagine that Christ himself experienced loneliness. Christ himself experienced dear friends letting him down. He experienced the ultimate betrayal by a false friend, you know. So we can ask ourselves, well, maybe we've been betrayed. Maybe we've unwittingly been the betrayer. You know, there are lessons there from us. So he just gives a lot of beautiful lessons looking at how Christ experienced loneliness. And I'll tell you another little favorite one from insight from here is when St. Thomas More, you know, who, if I remember right, he was sentenced to be, like, you know, drawn and quartered in this horrific death. And King Henry VIII, who was his friend, commuted that to beheading, you know, so he wouldn't suffer intensely before the death. But he was destined, you know, he was to be executed. So he's writing about the martyrs, you know, Christians who have suffered death from the faith, as St. Thomas More himself would then become. And he said, you know, we have all these stories, a lot of stories of these very brave martyrs. I'm trying to think, is it St. Lawrence, they say, who's being roasted on a spit and says, you know, oh, you can turn me over now, I'm done on this side. I mean, there's some extreme examples of stories out there. But Thomas More basically says, and he's talking as if it's in the words of Christ. He says, you know, he said, let people have their brave martyrs. They're out there, you know, by the thousands. He said, but for those who are more humble and timid, he said, you know, just follow me. He said, you know, just grab a hold of my garment and feel some power coming out of it, and I'll be there to sustain you. Showing how Christ himself, in his human nature, you know, experienced pain, he experienced fear, he experienced loneliness. So in the Christian sense, you know, we try to join our sufferings to Christ, realize that he was willing to experience these things. We can too. And as Christians, we then know it's never going to be permanent, because in life in heaven, there will be no loneliness. You know, we're there with all the communion of saints. So anyway, that chapter on the loneliness of Christ, I borrowed mostly from a very insightful book by St. Thomas More.
So I think, on a personal level, in terms of the real benefit of solitude, is these things, which I actually wrote down myself to sort of use as a mantra. Quiet the noise, give yourself fresh perspective, ask yourself questions, learn from your mistakes, and grow. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, I think that's beautiful. That's a beautiful summary. How to turn a potentially negative situation into a very, very good one for actual growth, you know? The kind of growth that is going to help you, it's going to help whoever's lonely during this time. And if we're sharing that with others, it's going to help them too. So I think that's a beautiful, beautiful summary of the lessons, the kind of things that we can obtain from periods of solitude, you know, whether we choose them or whether they're imposed upon us.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What are simple acts we can carry out to reach out to the lonely, even if we are lonely ourselves? And at the point of recording and publishing this video, I'm assuming that a lot of people are feeling that because of the lockdown. So unless the lockdowns were lifted, who knows? But what are some acts that we can do, Kevin?
Yeah, and here I kind of think it begins with just the idea that be aware, boy, they're not probably not going to tell us, but they're lonely all around us. You know, perhaps even one every three piece and we persons we see are going to be lonely. Just kind of have an awareness there that the way we react to these people can make a difference in their life. So I say it starts as simple as something, you know, if you're stuck in an elevator with a person, instead of looking away, maybe just consider making eye contact or saying hello. Just some simple gesture. I remember reading in one book by a psychiatrist, he's saying, case of a man who was contemplating suicide, and I don't know if he had written this down, he said he was going to walk along this long bridge and jump. He said, but if one person was kind to him along the way, you know, acknowledged his existence, he wouldn't jump, you know? So we never know the state that another person might be in, where just the simplest act might make some kind of difference to them. And in certain cases, you know, maybe, you know, not often, but it might open up a new relationship. It might help both you and them. So simple things like acknowledging people, making eye contact, saying hello, and maybe inviting people to do a simple thing. In modern books in America, I don't know if there's a tradition there. I mean, I'm not sure how worldwide it is, but it used to be a thing like a woman in the housewife's making something for supper and she needs a cup of sugar. She doesn't have one. So it used to always be, we're going to go knock on the neighbor's door next door and get a cup of sugar, you know, whereas now it's going to be, you're going to hop in your car and you're going to drive down to the grocery store or the corner drugstore or something and pick some up. So just little things like that, maybe trying to know our neighbors if they're open to it. Possibly something you even mentioned earlier, look at the possibility of reestablishing in some way old relationships that have ended for some reason or another. Maybe you're bearing a grudge against a person, consider making some form of contact again, whether or not it can be like it used to be. Just kind of keep an awareness of that it can be a good thing to please other people. Sometimes we have in our modern culture the idea that if you're trying to please people, it just means you're weak and you're a wimp, you know. But there's something good there if you're actually going around thinking, how can I brighten up another person's day? Well, we do have this idea. They call it random acts of kindness. Now, I think that's the same idea. So we can think in those terms. I think in terms of trying to make more connections wherever you are. Just to give you one example. I've talked before. I've always been such a big weightlifter. I always enjoyed it. And I enjoy the activity itself, but I also enjoy the socialization that comes with it. Because actually, I've met some of the best friends in my life there. I actually met my wife in a gym. I was her lifting instructor. And what's a change I see over time? Well, now we're in the lockdowns. At least where I am, we can't even go there. It's been months. But in my experience now, when I go to the gym, there's a fair number of people, especially younger people, who are plugged in the whole time, you know, with earbuds and a cell phone. Whereas in the past, the gyms were a great opportunity for social interaction because people would simply, you know, greet and talk to each other. So I would say a lesson there that might apply not only to the gym is maybe in just terms of our cell phone use and use of our devices, maybe see if we can temper ourselves to try to use them as little as necessary out in public so we are more open to acknowledgement and in interaction with others.
Well, you've just led me on very well to my next point, social media. Often in times of loneliness, we can sometimes draw comparison to those around other people, possibly even breaking lockdown rules or, you know, being so busy, partying, having loads of friends, having these amazing lives. And there we are, all alone, no one to call, no one to see, all by ourselves. What do you say to the people who can't get away from their social media because it's, in a way, it's the only way they can stay connected to people, but also feel so negative seeing all of these images and videos of people being the opposite of lonely?
Yeah, and that's a real issue now. Because I don't want to give the impression, too, that I'm totally against cell phones or social media, because there are so many possible, you know, excellent uses of them, too. For social media, yeah, I mean, different parts of the world, I see some of that myself. I see a video of a famous strongman. He's out there back in his gym in California. Hey, I can't go to mine yet here where I am in Illinois in the USA, but it's coming soon, I think. But yeah, so we can watch that with social media. You know, it can allow us to make connections that we normally wouldn't take the time to make, or it can allow us to, you know, of course, connect with people that we're not allowed to see face to face right now, but hopefully that'll be ending soon. I think, you know, I don't know if you've noticed this, Stephen, but But myself, you know, when I go through the main social media I use, and I don't use too many. I'd mainly use Facebook. But I see there too, we have the peril, especially with so many issues going on in the world, of that polarization, you know. Just seeing people who are using this time to speak out so vociferously, you know, just on one side or another of issues. So my personal take, you know, I'm always tempted to jump in there myself. I also try to keep in mind, if I'm going to use the social media, can I do something positive, just something light, something that we realize that even though the world around us, there's serious problems going on, we can still at our personal level, you know, lead decent lives, try to make meaningful connections with each other. So to try to offer some messages of hope and just normal daily existence through the social media.
And finally, Kevin, I mean, there's so many ways and we've gone into it in detail, but let's say somebody's listened to us talk this entire time. And if you have, thank you, because it's been absolutely fascinating as always. How can they really truly overcome loneliness?
Yeah, and here, you know, of course, it's no easy thing. It'll vary. It's, again, at some point in our lives, most of us are likely to be lonely for such a variety of reasons: a relocation, a broken relationship, you know, the loss of a loved one, a lockdown. I mean, all kinds of things can produce that sense of loneliness. But just to know that, you know, we do have the capacity to endure it. Some people who've encountered harsh circumstances that lead to loneliness may someday come and look back and say, as hard as that was, I'm glad it's happened, you know, because of those lessons I learned from it, like the list that you gave us, because it gave them ways to listen to themselves, to slow down, you know, to learn and to grow. So you may come back and say, this hurts now, but it was a good thing, you know. And one of the ways is, I know what it's been like to be lonely, so maybe now I'm a little better equipped to notice the signs in somebody else, to help lift them from their loneliness. Because kind of the great irony of this is, you know, everything that I would advise to us, try to help and, you know, reach out to a lonely person, pretty much also applies to a person who's already lonely, to do the same kind of things, you know, to be aware that you too are surrounded by lonely people. And even though you're lonely, and even though it's hard to do, your little positive acts can make a very big difference in that person's life. And again, it might lead to a new meaningful relationship, you know, maybe even ideally in some cases to a new high and real virtuous friendship for yourself and that person.
And if they want to read more and learn more about you, what's the name of your book, which the link will be in the description?
Yeah, that book was called The Catholic Guide to Loneliness: How Science and Faith Can Help Us Understand It, Grow From It, and Conquer It. It is from Sophia Institute Press, and it's on, you know, all the major electronic book sites, booksellers.
And one last time, Kevin, thank you very much for being here again and for your kind words as well. But I don't want you to repeat yourself, but I'm going to quote somebody who might be feeling like this. But Kevin, but SCG Stephen, I still feel lonely. I haven't got the motivation. I can't get out of this funk that I'm in, this rut that I'm in. Please help me. Is there anything you can say to me that can make me feel better right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not easy, of course.
No pressure.
Yeah. You know, that you can say, yes, I truly am lonely. And yes, it's hard to deal with loneliness, but God gave me the equipment to deal with hard things. I can deal with hard things. I can overcome them. I can endure them. This loneliness is likely temporary. The more I take action, the shorter the time is likely to be. But even if it hurts, I can go on and I can reach out and look for another person who might be hurting and try to do some small thing within my power to make a difference for that person.
Hey, podcaster, you made it right to the end of the show. That's quite commendable. Well done. What did you think? Did you like it? Did you hate it? All feedback is much appreciated by me, so please get in touch with me, even if you fancy being a guest on my show. Head over to scgshow.com or contact me through my YouTube channel, as I respond to almost everybody who gets in touch. Have a great day. Stay safe. Keep podcasting.